It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Many years ago, when the planet Krypton, home of a race of supermen, exploded in space, the sole survivor was an infant boy who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Today, that boy, grown to manhood, is known as Superman.
How does it look?
Just like any other oil well.
Above ground, sure, but take my word for it, it's the deepest ever drilled.
Well, that's more than 6 miles down.
Good heavens, practically to the center of the Earth.
Just what was in that report? I mean the one that you sent to the home office.
You're the newspaper man.
That's right, I'm Clark Kent from Metropolis Daily Planet.
Oh, they had the bodies of moles and great big human heads. They were just horrible. Those creatures killed that poor old man, and they wanted to kill me.
Like you that make it difficult for people to understand one another.
You're not going to shoot those little creatures. Save your time and ammunition, Benson.
Here, we aim to get it and string it up.
Who's going to stop me?
Well, you got Superman.
If he can't stop them, nobody can.
Now I'm going to give you one last chance to stop acting like Nazi stormtrooper.
You give the impression you're leading a double life.
Really?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as per usual, I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is always a pleasure to be here.
It is at that. And after a very long wait, I have Mr. Michael Bailey with us, and Michael and I have been talking, kind of forever, trying to figure out when a good time to record is, and, you know, then some time goes by, and then one of us reaches out to the other saying, you know, we got to record something. So I thought this episode would be the perfect one for Mike, and we'll get into that in a moment, but how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing fantastic, yes, it has been way too long. it just seems like personal things keep getting in the way of us getting together. Something is keeping us apart, Paul.
Something the is universe keeping us apart. Does not want us to be friends.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with that, but still.
So, you know, again, we've been talking about various different projects to do together. And, you know, What happened was Sean and I were also kind of going over, well, what haven't we covered, you know, that's older? You know, new things are easy to figure out. Oh, let's do this one. Let's do that one. But old things, you know, we talk a little bit, and one of the ideas that came up was, well, you know what, let's look at whatever superhero movies we haven't covered. And then, basically, as far as I'm concerned, starting at the beginning is Superman and the Mole Men. I mean, you could go into the serials and things like that, but this, for me, this is the beginning. So I suggested this, and then, you know, several light bulbs went on over my head, the first of which was, well, years ago, Michael and myself and Andrew Leyland and Bob Fisher all did I think it came close to a 4-hour extravaganza discussing the Adventures of Superman TV show, in which I'm sure we covered this to a small extent. And then the combination of that and the fact that I've been wanting to try and find something to record with Mike, made me say, you know what, let me ask Mike to see if he's available and get him in here with us. Just by way of background, this might be the building block on which my comic book love is built. My initial introduction to the comic book heroes is either this series, not this movie, the Batman TV show, the Spider-Man cartoon of 68, or the Marvel Superheroes cartoon. Because I'm not sure which one was the first one to kind of catch my eye, because they all are mixed together in my young childhood. But they even predate Super Friends for me. So, you know, most people say Super Friends was their first introduction. This is quite possibly my first introduction, you know, along with those other things. And I'm fighting, as I was watching it for the purposes of today's show, I had to fight to try and keep nostalgia from being the total thing that ruled my thought process. And I already have it figured that at the end of the episode, I'm going to give my review personally, or my rating personally, and then my objective rating based upon not my, you know, without nostalgia in it at all. And we'll see how close those two come together, because I always leave a little flexibility for the conversation to move me elsewhere. But I love this movie. I have always have. I always will. I had seen it really, I don't think I ever saw it as a movie until it was released on home video. When I was growing up, it was broken into two parts, and it was called The Unknown People, and it was two episodes of the Adventures of Superman series. That's the one I remember watching. But I remember watching, you know, the show in the afternoons, and it was kind of special when this one came on because it was a two-parter. It made it seem, you know, much more significant than the others. So, again, it was always special to me, and we'll get into the individual things about it, and we'll talk about it. I have some notes that I made, which I was already looking over, and they're really stream of consciousness. I don't have any kind of organization to my notes, but we'll get there. Why don't we throw it out to Sean first and see, you know, what's your experience with this series slash movie?
Kind of similar to yours. Batman 66 was like my real introduction into superheroes. It was enjoying that show and syndication growing up was just great. The Spider-Man cartoon, just like you mentioned, that late 60s Spider-Man cartoon was just fantastic. This came later in syndication. I remember, I don't think I've seen every episode of this, which is shocking to me just because of how much I love George Reeves. But I saw this originally as the two-parter like you, but it's been a long time. I've owned this multiple times, you know, as far as I bought the DVD version and then got it digitally. And I never got around to watching it like this until we were doing this piece. I love George Reeves. There's so much I love about this. There's going to be certain pieces of this that I'm talking about that almost are going to seem like criticisms. They're not. They're observations. And it's really more, I think I'm comparing this now to the Christopher Reeves portrayal of Superman, which was something that I just found interesting watching this. But some of the pieces that I'm going to bring up that I just kind of noticed in this one are going to be things that are just more observations between the two different portrayals of him and, in particular, Lois Lane in this particular story. But I'm glad we did this because I don't think I've ever seen this as one complete piece. And I also didn't realize this is the one that kicked it all off.
This is effectively the pilot.
But
how about you, Mike? And I know you have experience with this one.
You know, it's funny. We're all different points on the age spectrum, which is the polite way of saying I'm a little younger than you both. it's funny that we all share like the Batman television series as like a cornerstone of our building blocks of being into comics and stuff, because that was in such heavy syndication. This one, George Reeves Superman, came a little later. I had always been into the Super Friends. I'd always been into the Christopher Reeve films before I got into the comics. But this one was, I don't want to say I came in kicking and screaming, but it wasn't in heavy syndication when I was a kid. I know in one area we lived in, it was on the local PBS station, and in my 7-year-old mind, I was just like, well, this is the old Superman, because I was 7, so please forgive me for that. But when I got into the comics and when I realized, well, I really love this character, I want to learn more about them. And I think Paul will know what I'm talking about. I don't know where you're located, Sean, so I'm not trying to leave you out of this. WOR Channel 9 in New York City on Thanksgiving in the late 80s would show marathons of the George Reeves series. And Jack Larson hosted them, and that was my real introduction to it. He would like give like a little anecdote before the episode, and then they would play a select number of episodes. This has become this movie and the first and second season of the show have become some of my favorite Superman ever. I just love it. I'm like Sean. I've not seen every single episode yet. I'm leaving some stuff to discover later. I remember, Paul, you telling me when we recorded a 4-hour extravaganza on the series that you were kind of jealous of the fact that there was parts of the show that I hadn't discovered yet. But this movie, I'm kind of like Paul. It was when it was on VHS. I found it at a video store in the mid 90s and popped it in, and I was just like, wow, this is different. Just because, you know, with Superman films, and yes, at that time we only had the Reeve films, you had like the big bombastic John Williams score, or John Williams theme, or in the case of Superman 3, kind of a light and jaunty comedy of errors music. But this one starts off very different, but I gotta say, I not to put the cart before the horse, I just loved it. I loved it then. I loved it last night when I watched it again. And I can't wait to just dig into it.
So I think the first order of business for me is George Reeves as Superman. Christopher Reeve is, to my knowledge, most of the people I know, that's, you know, if you ask them, they say, that's my Superman. That's him coming off the page and being Superman. And I get it, because he was pretty much picture perfect and he played the part great. But George Reeves is my Superman. Christopher Reeve is not. And you know, I remember when they first announced, because I'm a little older than you guys, probably a lot older, but that's besides the point. But I remember when they announced that they were making Superman the movie, and I just assumed Christopher Reeve had to be related to George Reeves just because of the name. But there's something about his portrayal that always grabs me. And again, I'm talking about George now. First of all, the fact that it always feels like he's aware that he's playing the part. It always feels like he's winking at the audience when he's, you know, when he looks and he says, maybe it is Lois, maybe it is, or something like that. It always feels like, you know, like he knows, he's totally self-aware. But one of the things I love about it, and I don't criticize Christopher Reeve for the way he did it, because I think that's what they were going for, but I love that he plays a confident Clark Kent. He's not fumbling. He's not pretending. I mean, it's crazy to think that people don't realize he's Superman, you know. But other than that, I love the fact that Clark Kent is a competent and very, very self-confident person who's not going to be bullied around by people. You know, every once in a while you get the kind of the Lois saying, oh, you know, you disappear when trouble comes around. But other than that, there's no indication at all of him being, you know, cowardly or fumbly or clumsy or anything like that. He's, you know, he's a seasoned reporter with experience, and he's got connections, and he's, you know, usually calling the shots, let's do it this way or let's do it that way. He looks the part to me, you know, especially if you're looking at like 1950s Superman in the comics. You know, I think that's probably about when Wayne Boring was drawing him. And Wayne Boring, to me, is famous for the barrel-chested Superman, which is what we have with George Reeves. You know, he's not a later muscle guy. You know, it's not from the era where Arnold Schwarzenegger is showing us how to be muscle bound. He's just a big burly guy, but you know, with not at all fat in any way, but you know, he looks intimidating in his own way. And he's, to me, he's perfect. And I'm assuming you're going to both tell me Christopher Reeve is your Superman. So let's see where you go with that point.
It's kind of what we were saying earlier. It's funny when you're talking about WR. I'm in Ohio. So WR Channel 9 actually aired here on cable. So we hit a point in time where I was actually getting WR, even though I live here. But this show, its accessibility is a lot of what Mike was saying before, as far as it wasn't always available to me. So it was, when it was on, I loved it. I loved watching it. I thought, like you, Paul, that when they announced Christopher Reeve, that he was somehow related to George Reeves. I kind of was connecting the names and that type of thing. Christopher Reeve was my Superman. I'll say that hands down. But one of the things that I always find with George Reeves is he is Superman to me. When you see him, he's got that presence. There's something just he like has that confident kind of Superman swagger. Also, as Superman, he's very comforting. Whereas Clark Kent, you're mentioning his confidence before. There's certain points of time where Clark Kent is downright cocky. And I'm not saying that as a criticism. It's the portrayal of him that's a little bit more like when you look back at the animation and stuff that was going on with him in media. That was kind of how Superman was back then, or Clark Kent was back then. But it was interesting how prominent Clark is, not only here, but overall in the show. Clark Kent is a big focal player. His confidence is definitely there. There's times in this, if there's a slight criticism I have, in the storytelling, it's Lois sits there and always like references twice in this what a coward he is, and he runs away in situations. I don't know. I think dude's proved himself more than once that like he's standing up to mobs, he's doing this, he's like he's running towards danger far more than he's running away. It's the part where Lois was like referencing the fact Clark just runs away at the first. I'm like, I don't know, Lois, you're kind of forcing that one on me, because my feeling on Clark Kent is this is to your point, Paul, he's very competent. I actually really like his portrayal of Clark Kent. It's different than the Christopher Reeve one, but I find myself liking Clark. I like that Clark's an investigator. It does force Lois into the background, which is something I'm not used to in my Superman storytelling, but it's not a criticism. It's just kind of this, that's what this version is. And it does it very well. I find this comfort food and really enjoyed every moment with it. I like George Reeves a great deal.
I have come to love George Reeves. By default, I was kind of issued Christopher Reeve based on when I was born, because it's almost like he was always Superman. Though in recent years, oddly enough, Tyler Hoechlin has supplanted him as the Superman in my head, mainly because Tyler Hoechlin's Clark Kent Superman is the closest I've ever seen in an adaptation of the Superman, the Superman that, like I said, that lives in my head. That's the closest I've ever seen it portrayed. So it's not that one is bad and one is good. It's just one matches my view of who the character is more than others. But I love George Reeves for several reasons. One, like you all said, he's very confident in both roles. His portrayal of Clark Kent is very much in line with the radio show, which at this point, when this movie came out, had only just gone off the air after like 11 years. And Clark Kent in that series was just as integral to the story as Superman was. It was like Clark did everything until Superman was absolutely needed, and then Superman would come out. And that makes sense because the producer of the first season of The Adventures of Superman was Robert Maxwell. I almost said Bill Maxwell. He was the FBI agent and the greatest American hero. That's completely different. So it makes sense that this Clark Kent Superman is kind of in line with that Clark Kent Superman. George Reeves is just, he sets you at ease. I think the guys that play Superman the best are the ones that do not look like they're embarrassed to be in the costume, that just kind of have a confidence in both roles. And more than anything, if you, I'm a post-crisis Superman kid in the comics. That's when I came in. That's what launched everything that I do. It was about a year into the John Byrne revamp, I dove in. And if you talk to all of those creators in the late 80s and early 90s, most of them will tell you this was what they grew up on. So this is in the DNA of that version in the comics, too. So it's like by default, I have to like this. But I agree with you both, too. Man, every time Lois was just like, you know, oh, there he is running off again, I'm like, Lois, are you really paying attention to what's going on? Because, yeah, he runs off, but help usually follows. So maybe you need to use your reporter instincts to start digging into that. But then I realize it's 1951. This is just the setup. This is how it is. It was especially that way in the comics as well at the time, or getting into that way at the time. So, but I love that his Clark Kent, like Paul was saying, isn't a shrinking violet, isn't somebody who pretends to be afraid of everything, that is kind of a go-getter. The common criticism of this series and George Reeves in general was that there wasn't much of a difference between his Clark Kent and Superman. And on one hand, I can kind of see where they're coming from on a superficial level. But if you really look at how, especially in this film, he plays it, Clark is a competent reporter. There's a great scene early in the film where everybody basically goes back to the hotel except Clark and the one guy. And he looks at him, he goes, well, I guess you know why I wanted to stay behind. And then he starts digging in as a reporter. He's trying to get the story. And I was just like, wow, that's something that sometimes gets lost with early Silver Age Clark, is that he was actually a really good reporter. He worked at the Daily Planet. They said in several times in this movie, it's the greatest paper in the world, in the country. So if he's there and if he's who they sent, along with Lois, then they have to be some of the top people. Either that, or it was a, you know, that. I guess it could be seen that this isn't a nothing burger story, so they sent two of their stringers. But I don't think that's quite how it worked out. But no, I absolutely love George Reeves in the role. I have sometimes a hard time separating everything I know from behind the scenes and the history of George Reeves as a person and him in the role, but once you start watching it, you just completely get lost in him as Clark and Superman.
Yeah, I think he just had a certain amount of charisma about him that you feel comfortable with him, kind of as Superman and as Clark for that matter. Now, just a couple of points on that is the confident Clark was the way he's written in this. He's almost given too much leeway by the town of Silsby. First of all, when the mob starts forming, he tells the sheriff, let me handle this. And the sheriff backs off, which I just find amazing. And the doctor lets him perform surgery with him. Now, the second point I can kind of accept a little bit more, because there was no choice. There was no one else around. He needed somebody to assist him in some way, and no one else was coming near this little green man. So the second point I get. The first point, it's like, you know, why would the sheriff should be saying, you know what, Kent, you aren't even part of this town. Get out of the way and let me do my job. So I find that kind of amusing. The other thing is, I think Lois's comments about, you know, was it? He gets himself in a jam and runs away. I think that's all script writing shorthand to try and create a distinction between Clark and Superman. To say, hey, you know what? We know you look, and you could see that George Reeves, you know, isn't well disguised by putting on a pair of glasses. But this is the way Lois views him. And we're showing you that they don't see him the same in both roles. So that's kind of the way I took that. You know, I think it's a hard thing to swallow, but I think that's what they're going for. I wanted to mention, and I thought about this long and hard while I was watching it. I think this is my lowest, too. I think Phyllis Coates is my lowest. I got to say, Noelle Neal comes very low on my list of lowest's, because I don't see why Superman would be attracted to her. But then, you have some other actresses that are beautiful, some other actresses that are really good. But Phyllis Coates, she looks attractive. She acts, she has her own confidence about her. When it comes time to stand up to people, she feels like, you know, she feels like the Lois from the comics of the day, without being the joking, you know, the silly, oh, I want to marry Superman, and I just, my whole goal in life is just to reveal his identity. You eliminate that, but other than that, she feels like the Lois of the day. She feels very competent as a woman reporter who is in a man's world and still doing well. So I think she may be my Lois.
She used to be my favorite. Again, Bitsy Tulloch recently kind of overtook her. And I almost, like, again, hate saying that, because then it sounds like, you know, Bitsy Tulloch came running into the ring with a chair and took out Phyllis Coates. That's not what happened, thankfully. But it's funny, there's a podcast right now hosted by a guy named Anthony Desiato, who's covering the George Reeves series. And he did his first season was obviously about the first season. And to a person, everybody that came on said something like the following: I love Noelle Neal, but Phyllis Coates is. And it just seems like everyone loves Noelle Neal, because she's kind of like, if George is the dad of Superman, she's the mom Lois Lane for several generations of fans. And she was given a very different series to deal with, especially towards the end of the run of Adventures of Superman. The shows got very lighthearted, is the best way to describe it. You know, when you watch that first season, it's crime noir fiction with Superman, and that's not the show she was handed, because they retooled it after the first season for a number of reasons. I love Phyllis Coates for everything Paul said. I really can't, it's almost like no notes, can't add anything to that. She just had a confidence that I think is required for this character. She has to stand on her own. And at no point in this story is her role ever kind of sidelined in favor of Superman. She's kind of fully integrated into it. She gets roughed up at one point. I mean, that's pretty hardcore for this time period, of seeing, like, you know, she's right there in it against the mob. And yes, Superman comes in and saves the day, but then again, it was like 3 against 30. So they kind of needed to even the odds there. Her attitudes towards Clark are, again, I agree with Paul. I think it's just script shorthand for we're trying to differentiate these characters. This is the role this person plays. This is who Lois is. She is somebody that works with Clark, that doesn't seem to dislike Clark, but also seems to think he's kind of a coward because he seems to disappear whenever things get rough. But she's also willing to stand in the front, and until gunfire starts happening. And she's there for the story. One of my favorite parts is that she wants to immediately call the home office and report on what they're seeing. And it's George Reeves who's just like, no, we can't do that. That's going to cause a mass panic. And that was an interesting dichotomy between the two of them. She's focused solely on the story. That doesn't mean she's a bad person, but that's who Lois Lane is as a character, and it's how she has to be, because she is a woman in 1951 in a predominantly male workplace. So she has to stand up. She has to differentiate herself from it and be more aggressive in wanting to get the story. But she is also the one that gets the final word in this movie. She delivers the last line of dialogue and kind of sums everything up. So the writer of this film was not using her as a prop. He wasn't just putting her in there just to have her. I think it's very telling that for what is essentially the pilot to the television series, the three other main characters are nowhere to be seen. But you have to have Superman, Clark, and Lois for the story to happen.
I was lucky enough to meet Noelle Neal at Mid-OhioCon when she was here and to get her signature. So, admittedly, I've got a soft spot for her because of the fact that she was in the serials and the fact that she jumped over to this show too later on. But Phyllis Coates was actually the first Lois Lane outside of Margot Kidder that I had ever seen. I think I saw Phyllis Coates first, but I'm kind of like, I'm always kind of flip-flopping between what did I see first, Superman the movie or this show. I'm having trouble with the timelines on that piece. But I really, when you look at this as being, this was the launching point into the series. The way that they used Lois in this, especially for the time frame we're referencing, was fantastic. The mob scene, Mike, you mentioned the mob scene in particular. I really liked the fact that, like, she was standing her ground and was kind of getting shoved around. And I'm like, wow, I didn't really expect them to have Lois kind of be behaving in that capacity. Even when Clark's doing an investigation, she's like, I want to be involved. I want to go. I'm not going to just sit here when you're on to something. I liked seeing the reporter curiosity from her end where she's like, there's a story here. I want to be a part of it. And that was something they portrayed really well. They had 58 minutes in this to really introduce certain core concepts. And the relationship between Lois and Clark and who Lois is and why I should even care that Lois is here was something that I thought that they established very well in this story, considering everything else that was going on. She was a really good actress in this.
See, as a kid, and I think this kind of goes to what Michael was saying about them retooling the series to make it, basically what they did is they made it more kid friendly as it went on. As a young kid, you know, a single digit kid watching this, I do remember feeling a little bit more comfortable with Noelle Neal at the time because Phyllis Coates was harsher. She was harder. She was more cold. And then it's as you get older and you realize, you know, what she's dealing with and what's going on that you can grow to appreciate her more. I think the difference to me, ultimately, the biggest difference is Noelle Neal, because of the way the show was written, had to often be the damsel in distress. Phyllis Coates does not feel like the damsel in distress, even when the mob is against her. She's got overwhelming odds against her, but she never feels like, you know, like they're going to tie her to the railroad tracks, which eventually they do with Noelle Neal. That's just the way it is. So, you know, it's a combination of, I think her portrayal was really solid and the fact that I liked the way, you know, in looking back on it, I liked the way it was written more. So again, she's probably my Lois. Before we get into different things about the production and specific elements of the story, I was thinking as I was watching this, you know, as a kid up until, you know, a couple of days ago when I watched it for the purposes of doing this show, I always just thought of this as something that was put together for, you know, just for entertainment. It's a pilot show and they're trying to put together a story that's going to be appealing to children and above. And that was it. I never really thought about any subtext or anything underneath the surface of it. And I was trying to, while I was watching it, I was trying to put that together. And I saw really kind of two things. One was and they are interrelated in some ways. I saw it a connection to the movie, which was right around the same time, of The Day the Earth Stood Still, if you guys are familiar with that particular film, of really portraying the people as kind of the bad guys who instigate the violence that occurs because of their ignorance. And, you know, that I never saw that subtext before as I was watching it. And then I'm seeing, okay, you know what? The little green men, which is what we always called them when I was a kid, they are a substitute, I think, for the Red Menace, which was prevalent at the time. And what's really interesting about it is taking that Red Menace thing and then adding it to The Day the Earth Stood Still, where you're not showing the Red Menace as really being the bad guys. They are the thing that instigates it, but they are never really violent against anyone until it's instigated. So I really just found it fascinating to look at it from that perspective, which I never saw before.
Yeah, there's two levels going on here for me, because I remember when I first watched the episodes and then watched it as a complete film, I kind of clocked, oh, they're trying to kind of say something here. That was very much what the radio show did after World War II, starting around 1945, 1946. They made a concerted effort to, on the radio series, to do to be socially aware and preach against hate and intolerance. There were several storylines where they dealt with this. There was one called the Hate Mongers Association. Then there was, of course, one of the most famous, the Klan of the Fiery Cross, where they were fighting the KKK in all but name. And so having those themes explored here, where Superman, you know, is basically telling the crowd at one point, he flat out says it, stop acting like Nazi stormtroopers. And this is 1951, so we're only 6 years after the war, so it's still very fresh in people's minds. And I kind of am wondering if there was any kind of backlash back then. I mean, if this came out today, I'm sure there would be certain groups that would be pushing against it because they say it has a perceived agenda, but that's just the world we live in today. I don't know what it was like in 1951. But it's very much standing up just for tolerance in general, but kind of daring. I don't know if they would have done this 3 years later during the height of McCarthy and the blacklisting and all that, because this is pretty preachy for what is ostensibly a kid's B-reeler. That, yes, was intended to kind of launch the TV series, but it was also released theatrically. It was probably not the main feature, but it was probably one of either the second or third one. But yeah, just the whole idea of Lois at the end saying, they're saying, you live your way and we'll live our ways. And, you know, we're going to be cool with each other like that. Don't come looking for trouble. The bad guy being the humans, you know, that goes all the way up to today in like zombie fiction, where the zombies usually aren't the villains of the piece. It's other human beings to be shown the monsters. So I think for 1951, this is a very nuanced story, and especially something that's, you know, aimed probably predominantly as kids. It's trying to kind of show them that, you know, mob mentality bad, hatred just because they are the other is bad. We don't know anything about them, so don't come guns a-blazing. Also, one of the big things is we invaded them. They didn't just pop out and start showing up. It was because they were digging for oil and drilled into their world that they came up at all, and it looked like it was just an exploratory group, because they're looking around. They're not trying to come out and talk to anybody. They're just kind of trying to feel out what's going on around them, and it's only because one of them gets shot that they go back and get the vacuum cleaner of doom. So it's I love that part of it, because it feels very much of the Superman of the time period. He is the champion of the weak and the oppressed. And this kind of goes along with that.
I want to know what it's like down there, like in their world, because they came up and took a look around. And I mean, for obvious reasons, they were attacked and stuff like that. But they went back and they're like, we're done. I don't want to come back again. one of the things that I thought was refreshing, especially for the time period of this, this is kicking off the Superman television series. And the real ending of the story is the survival of the aliens. It wasn't like the winning of the battle or anything like that. They survived the experience of being up here with a mob. And I just think that that's pretty fresh storytelling for the time. You know, it's to be able to kick off a show with that. That's not something that's like midway through, like, let's do something a little different. No, we're starting off with this. It's a pretty unique way to begin this. You know, you don't have that clear-cut villain. You could make an argument that, like, Luke Benson's the villain of this story and the mob that he's created is the villain, and I wouldn't disagree with that argument. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's Superman and the Mole Men. So, you know, with the Mole Men being that primary piece of this, it's not that they're heroes. It's not that they're villains. They just get thrust into this circumstance where, hey, you, like, invaded my home. We came out to take a look around, and you people are shooting at us. one of my favorite sequences of this when it comes to the Mole Men was the child, played by Beverly Washburn. I think when you've got a kid who is able to just pull off that childlike innocence, and it did not look like acting. It looked like she was genuinely seeing these creatures. She was curious about them. They played ball together. And I thought that sequence was so sweet. It looked flawless. It was like this really cool, like, hangout with them in the moment. And when the mom came in that sequence and screamed, the adult not being able to see past this, and again, it's a mom who's got, it doesn't matter if they're aliens or not. You walk into your child's room and there's strangers in your child's room, you're going to scream. So that part I thought was just very organic in the way that that would just happen anyway. I just really liked that this was a unique kind of, I don't know what you, other than Luke Benson, I don't know what you define as a villain in this. And I like the story. It's just a different sort of story for the time.
Yeah, I was going to mention the scene with the little girl, and that was reminiscent to me of the Frankenstein monster playing with the little girl and unintentionally killing the little girl. And I could see where they're developing the kind of the apprehension, the suspense as to whether something is going to happen. Are they going to make her radioactive? Is she going to die? What's going to happen? But it also serves to show that they are innocent, these mole men. You know, that they can sit there just playing ball with a little girl and, you know, just rolling it back and forth, and they're, you know, enjoying that time. I think their innocence is also shown when they get all skittish when a snake comes by. You know, they're shown that they don't have this predilection to violence that the people do. They don't see something unknown and immediately respond by trying to subdue it. They're willing to stay back a little bit. So they are clearly not the villains of this piece. There's no question that they are not. And I'm sure, you know, when you went to the movie theater to see this as a feature, you were expecting the Mole Men to be violent and to, you know, Superman to have to battle them at some point. So, you know, it's a little bit of the taking your expectations and putting them on their ear a little bit, and I really like that aspect of it. My other question about the Mole Men, though, is as far as what we're supposed to think, you know, special effects and costuming aside, are they supposed to be kind of naked but hairy, or are they wearing clothes? Because I always just thought they were wearing clothes, and that brings me to another point in a moment. But then when Lois describes them, she's like, they look like little moles with human heads, and if they're wearing clothes, they don't look anything like moles.
That's actually something I didn't think about, because whenever I saw them, I flashed back to early 90s Saturday Night Live and Mike Myers, and Now Is the Time on Sprockets Where We Dance. But I think one of the before I answer reply to that, I wanted to make one point. You mentioned that the expectation is Superman fighting the Mole Man, and I think that would be, you know, a legitimate one. But I think the creators of the film kind of put it in the title. It's not Superman versus the Mole Man. It's Superman and the Mole Man, which is subtle, but I think it plays into what you were saying, Paul, about the overall expectation of the audience. I never thought that they were naked. I guess, you know, obviously they couldn't be. It's almost like if that's what they were going for, they would have put them in like a little bear suit or something to make it more. But you're right. They say it's, you know, they're outside of their hairy coverings. And I'm like, well, yeah, their hands are hairy, and I'm sure their feet are, so they're kind of like hobbits in a way. But yeah, that's a. Now, I'm gonna have existential dread about this all day now, wondering if they were nude or if they were wearing like black outfits.
But the other thing about that, the other point to build off that a little bit, is again in my mind they were always wearing kind of like onesies or something. And then, you know, they have the vacuum cleaner of doom that you mentioned, so. I start becoming fascinated thinking about 6 miles down, what type of society do they have down there? If they have tailors who are making clothes for them, and they have machinists who are making these weapons, which, you know, whether they're wearing clothes or not, they still come up with this machine, this vacuum cleaner thing that shoots death rays at people, which, at least the way they make it sound, is if Superman didn't step in, it would have eventually killed Benson. Although he walks away none the worse for wear, as it turns out. But that says to me that they have a fully realized society down there. It's not just like, you know, like these unthinking moles that are just burrowing through the ground and, you know, creating a little hobbit hole for themselves and being done. And then eating grubs and whatever. So that ends up being like a whole thing that opens up my imagination to what is life like down there and what are these mole men doing down there. And I guess we'll never find out because they told us you live your lives and we'll live ours.
They blew up the whole thing. I mean, like as far as the whole entryway to get to them. So they had that technology ready available too. You know, as far as whatever... I'm assuming that wasn't their ray gun that did that. I'm assuming they had something else down there that pulled that whole piece off. But I actually really like that we don't know what it was like down there, but there's a curiosity to that because I think that's great fiction when you're thinking beyond what they've given you. And I think that's something, you know, in this – when I was watching this the second time through, I ended up thinking a lot more about, like, what is going on down there? I love the fact that they, like I said, they came up and they kind of checked out. It is interesting that this film, for the time, was exploring such progressive themes. Because comics do this all the time. And I think if you're a regular comic reader, you are used to comics kind of taking a look at current society and using, you know, current stories as a way to just do contemporary explorations. But this show was really doing it at the time. And I think there's themes in here that we can still talk about today. that's where I think there's a success of the film in the sense that you mentioned before, Mike, how it like gets a little preachy. I think that's one of the things that it did well. Was kind of from a moral standpoint, you can kind of watch this and kind of just think, how do I interact with others? What is it like when I see something that's different? And that's kind of cool for a Superman story, I think, for it to be something where Superman and Clark Kent are kind of smacking me upside the head and making me think.
Yeah, one of the things that hit me on this viewing is that when the Mole Men came up with their weapon, I don't think they were out for revenge. I think they were just trying to get their fallen comrade. And they were like, okay, they shot one of us. They tried to light another one of us on fire in a pretty brutal way. We just want to get our guy and get back and get out of Dodge. And I think that's why it wasn't, for lack of a better term, I think they had the thing set on stun and not kill, to use a Star Trek term. Because it's like they kept shooting Luke Benson. And to be fair, Luke Benson had it coming because he's the one that
actually
shot
he didn't.
Friend. So
no, he had the older guy with him who said, "Let me take the shot."
Oh,
but he was believe me, he was the instigator of the shot.
Yeah, yeah, he was not innocent. I mean, and that's interesting. You know, Sean said something about, you know, there isn't a clear cut villain. I don't know if I quite agree with that. Luke Benson pulls a gun on the sheriff and punches him in the face. He completely disregards law and order, and it's a full-on like despot, and just like I think that's a bad guy.
Listen, I live in Mentor, Ohio. I regularly chastise the sheriff, and I've done 3 surgeries. So I'm just telling you, this is I don't know how you guys are living, but that's what Clark Kent does, and all this is pretty normal.
I've only done 1 surgery, so I guess you got me on that one. I never really thought about what it was like down there. But again, now thanks to y'all, it's in my head and it's going to live rent free there for quite some time. So
one of the things, just, you know, when you talk about the mole men when they come up, that I want to give some credit to, because the actors who are portraying the mole men, you know, I don't think anybody gives them credit for anything, to be honest with you. I don't think people really think about it. But if you see the way they're acting, their body language, because they have no lines, when they first come early in the movie, they look curious. They're a little skittish as to what's around, but they just seem curious. They're checking everything out. And then if you watch their body language when they come up with the Electrolux, they are clearly skittish at that point. They're nervous because one of their guys got shot. If I see it in the way that they move and the way that they're looking around and all of that, that it changes from curiosity to nervousness. And I think that's a pretty good job, you know, when you don't have any lines.
They look at the world like I look at, like when I look outside and see a raccoon or a deer. And I say that not diminishing anything. There's this, like, especially if you've seen them for the first time, or it's unusual to see them in the spot that they're in. I'd say deer's probably, we have a family of deer that come in our backyard, and it's intriguing. It's interesting. But here's what I'm not going to do. They are big, strong animals. I'm not going to put myself in their pathway. I'm not going to run up in front of them. I'm always very tentative, because if you spook them, you know, there's a possibility. We know those are, they put huge dents in vehicles. That's the danger of them, even though they're majestic and beautiful when you see them. It's that sense of, like, the way that they're interacting with the world is a cautious, even in the way that they walk and they carry themselves. I really enjoyed that. And the special effects remind me of, and I mean this as a compliment, of what I liked about the Twilight Zone TV series. Sometimes there's certain things in black and white that still hold up today, at least as much as it possibly can. Their outfits, I think if this was in color, I don't know that I would have been as I wasn't like sitting there looking at them with the way that they were dressed and made up and all that and going, oh, that's just some kind of man clearly in an outfit. I was really, these are the mole men. And I was totally captivated by that in the story, even though they're wearing, yes, they're wearing these, you know, zip up suits and things like that, whatever it was at the time. But I find that, like, in black and white, when you do costumes like that and the wigs and, you know, that they were doing to cover up their heads, it just holds up better. I wasn't noticing a lot of flaws. I wasn't noticing makeup areas or things like that sometimes you notice with color ones. That was something about this that I think was a victory, that it was in black and white, because I didn't find myself taken out of the story by, I watch a lot of old Doctor Who. And there's a certain era in the 70s where it's very, very clear that they're wearing rubber suits and things like that. I didn't feel that during this, I guess, is what I'm saying. And that was something that really struck me as because I watched this twice and I'm like, I'm not really focused on the fact that these are men wearing, you know, these wigs and costumes. And I thought that was something with the Mole Men too. I loved their whole interaction with the world. You're right, Paul. They aren't really credited for much of anything, but I thought what they did was really strong for kind of interacting with the world in a very different way.
Color or high definition would be anybody's friend on this particular production.
No, and I think that's proven when you watch like the television series on your big, you know, 50 plus inch widescreen high def television. These things were not meant to, but this was to a certain extent supposed to be high def because it was meant to be shown in the theater. But also, if you look at creature features of this time period, I don't think that was ever a consideration. I think they were just doing what they could afford to do at the time and tried to make it look as good as possible. Because Sean mentioned Doctor Who, that was meant to be shown on like a really tiny television set. So if you're noticing the rubber suits, it's, you know, showing its age. But when you blow it up on a big, huge screen, then obviously you're going to notice it. I was kind of impressed too. And this is going to come off as a criticism. It's really not meant to, because I'm contextualizing it with other movies of the time. There's a lot of what could be considered filler with them, of them just walking around or them just running from the mob that is chasing them. But to me, that was just more of showing them as characters instead of just a perceived threat or a prop or something. So, yeah, I agree with you guys totally. They did a lot with what they had, and especially like when they were in the scene with the little girl, especially they didn't know what to do. When the ball came to them, there was like a look of confusion. And then one of them kind of tentatively rolls it back, and then she brings it back to them. And then they're like, oh, this is communication. You know, and she is kind of our height. So maybe she is somebody that we can interact with on a less scary level than the giants that are walking around.
Now, just really brief, one of my favorite things in the movie, I just, Superman doesn't have a lot of action in the movie. And I think that's partially because of the story, partially because of budget limitations, partially because they hadn't totally developed how they were going to handle him for as far as you know, his superpower set and all that. But one of my favorite things is he isn't Uncle Clark all the time or Uncle Superman. He has a little bit of a temper here. And my favorite line that he delivers in this is when he saves Benson and Benson tries to thank him and he just says, it's more than you deserve. And he just walks away from him. I thought that was great. Like he's saying, you know, basically based on the person you are, you should have died now. I saved you because my morality forced me to, but that's it. I don't believe you should be living. At least that's the way I interpreted it. And I thought, you know, good. He's showing that he's not, you know, he's got his own real personality and he can be angered and he could be upset by the way people act. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, I love taciturn Superman. I love, this is very much golden age Superman that has had enough of everybody's crap. He is there. He's there to help. He is a figure of hope, but he's also somebody that's not that just doesn't put up with anything. And he immediately starts just chastising everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to a certain extent, at first he's trying to do it through, you know, through words. He's just like, look, this is the situation. They're not here to harm us. For one thing this, for one thing that. And then they start shooting at him. And I think at that point, he's just like, you know what? I've tried everything I can. I also have to admit, the unearned confidence of the town after emptying a gun into a man, they still want to attack him. I don't know. If I saw bullets bounce off a dude, I'm going to be like, okay, maybe we need to rethink this. This guy is not somebody we can take on. But that's another thing I loved about the early George Reeves is that he punched somebody in the face. I mean, just flat out knocked them out. And I'm just like, okay, I'm assuming he was pulling the punch because the guy's jaw didn't fly off. But this is a Superman that will preach tolerance and peace, but is not afraid to get his hands dirty and teach someone a lesson. I'm with you, Paul. I love when the guy thanks him and he's just like, shut up.
He took a punch too, George Reeves. I mean, when that sequence when the mob was coming after him, one of the mobsters went and punched him, and but I mean, it looked good. I mean, both looked good. To your point about the if it wasn't stunt work, I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm assuming it was really good stunt work.
There were two things in the movie that actually made me chuckle a little bit. And the first was reminiscent of the movie Vacation, National Lampoon's Vacation. If you remember, as they're driving cross country, and you know, he's saying, "Oh, if we don't go here, you're not going to see the world's biggest whatever ball or whatever it is." And I just think, you know, Silsby, home of the deepest oil well, like people are traveling across the country to go and look at this. I just thought that was like really, I don't know if it's what you want to brag about, especially since you haven't gotten any oil. You know, how deep are you going to dig before you say, you know what, maybe we got to dig in a different spot? 6 miles. They went down 6 miles.
What did he put in the shed? Remember at the beginning of the film, we had him, he was yelling at the guys to throw the tools in there, and then he had something wrapped up and he put it in the shed. Remember he yelled at the older guy who wound up dying?
I didn't think there was any great mystery to that. I thought he was just shutting down the well because he realized that there might be danger of what they were doing going down so deep.
I think you're right, but what I'm saying is I don't know that we ever got a resolution for this.
I know what you're talking about.
In this cloth-like towel, he pulls out something, and it's some kind of metal object of some sort. You never really get a clear look at what it really is. But he's secretive about it, covers it back up, goes to the shed, sticks it in the shed, yells at the other guy who was like sitting here, you know, just all he was doing was standing there. He just happened to be standing there, but he was yelled at as being like kind of nosy and all that. And he apologized to him. We had this whole scene where this happened and we never got any resolution to what that, like, what did he put in there? What was that? And I'm not saying that is a fault. It's one of the things that I'm going back to and going, wow, that was interesting that they had him put something in there and we never got to really know what that was. I wasn't criticizing the fact they were throwing I get what they were doing with the tools and all of that. That made a ton of sense. That was the only piece that I'm like, it's kind of a dangling plot thread. What was that?
So I clocked that too. And the thing that I, in my head, thought is that the tools were melted in a way that you were not supposed to be. There was some kind of damage to them that they're trying to shut this down because they've discovered something scary. And something is off about it. And he's trying to hide that fact. And that's why when the men are like, why are we getting rid of all this stuff? I think they think there's something potentially dangerous about it. You know, like they were constantly, again, this is not in the film. What if at night they went by and they noticed that all of the tools and stuff and the things that were coming up were glowing?
Yeah.
And because everything they touched glowed. So there's a phosphorescence down there. And again, they realized it wasn't radioactive, but it's just like, this is really weird. We need to hide this. And that's what I got out of that.
That would explain why he kept it wrapped up. It totally validates everything you're saying, because even when he put it in the shed, he had wrapped it up again before he put it in the shed. So it matches everything that you're saying. I actually really like that because it completely matches the storytelling.
Yeah, I that all makes sense to me. And it also makes sense from the perspective of the, you know, I I know they want to oversimplify things because you have 58 minutes to present a movie, but you're not necessarily going to believe a corporate person who's invested so much money in this well is just going to shut it down for no reason. So it does make sense to say, you know, he has seen that there's some sort of greater risk by going further down there, and that's why he wants to shut it down. So I think that makes total sense to me. You know, there were budgetary constraints, obviously, and also the technology of the time. I was a little disappointed we don't get the shot of Superman flying in the sky. All we do is get him, you know, leaping into the air, and then we have kind of an animated sequence where he catches the Mole Man. It's a disappointment, but, like, I don't fault the movie for that. The other thing, I'm just... stream of consciousness. The other thing that I got a kick out of was when the mob forms, somebody grabs the barber pole. Like they're going to use that. They're going to use that as a weapon. Yeah. I don't know. I just found that very amusing.
So on the effects, I think they were just, this is the pilot, for lack of a better term, and they were figuring things out. Special effects, and I cannot recommend enough Gary Grossman's Serial to Serial, which is one of the authoritative tones, not only on the serials, but this show as well. Also, there's a book out there called Flights of Fancy that covers the radio show in this show. That one's actually available on Audible if anybody consumes their books that way. I looked at the flying effects, and for somebody that is more used to the television series, it is so weird seeing George Reeves lift off the ground, like not, you know, hit the diving thing and like leap out of the thing. He actually raises up, and there's the famous story that during production of the show, one of the wires snapped, and he's just like, nope, not doing this ever again. I am not killing myself for this show. I also was interested that when they were showing him flying, they just showed like the road from the street, but it was going in the opposite direction. So I'm with you. It would have been neat to see more flying shots. But I'm also kind of fascinated that this is part of the evolution of portraying Superman on camera. Like this is the progression from animation to this, to George Reeves on the table, to Christopher Reeve.
All right. Well, we've exhausted my notes, and just, I'll throw out, you know, any other thoughts that you guys have to discuss.
The opening music, and the opening in general, it's interesting that this is a pilot episode and we only get like an explanation of the origin. We don't actually see like Krypton until the Superman on Earth episode. The opening music is pure early 50s sci-fi. There is nothing super heroic about it. In fact, after they get through like the mysterious part of it, they get into kind of a march. And all I kept thinking when I was watching that, I was hearing that is like, in the future, it's going to be about you. You know, kind of like, what's his name at the beginning of Ed Wood? You know, in the future, where we're all going to live. I just appreciated that all explanations of who Superman is seems to be like tacked on at the very beginning, and they have no time for it in the rest of the show. This is just an adventure of Superman. This isn't his origin. This isn't how he first revealed himself to the world. Clark Kent shows up. I could see this easily being one of the radio serials of Lois and Clark go into that town, things happening, and suddenly Superman has to come out to save things. But the music was the one where I was like, this is the most non-Superman theme ever.
Replaced by the second best Superman theme ever.
Yeah, Leo Claxton? I don't know how to pronounce that.
I mean, I can't
butcher it any further.
In good faith, say it's as good as John Williams' theme, but it's the second best. Anyway, so to rate this, I feel like, for me personally, this is Jaws. I love this movie. I've grown up with this movie. Well, in a different format, but I've grown up with it. I don't think I would ever flip through the channel, see that it's on, and keep going. I would just let it play. Or you know, when I say keep going, I wouldn't keep flipping through. I would stop, and I would be there for it. But trying to look at it objectively, trying to look at it from a production point of view, from somebody who doesn't have my love of the series, somebody who's never seen George Reeves play Superman before, I don't know. I'm thinking, you know, as long as you have curiosity about the character and you have a tolerance for the special effects of the 1950s, because you have to have both of those. But if you have both of those and you've never seen this, I think it's a Jaws 2. I think I got to put it there. But for me personally, it's just, you know, it's something I've always loved, and I'm never gonna step down from that.
I struggled on this one. A lot of the reasons you are. There's a nostalgia piece for me that easily gives it extra credit. So some of that you're going to have to take into account in where my final rating is. I was also, like you, kind of thinking more along the Jaws 2 lane. I settled on a Jaws 1, and here's the reason why. I feel it's a very unique story. I also feel like for somebody, if I were to sit there and say, if I want to know whether or not this era of Superman was for me, what could I watch that would give me that flavor and let me know if this is for me? I think this is a really good representation of this Superman. I think this is a great one to put in front of somebody and sit there and say, hey, you're going to watch this, and this is either going to be your cup of tea or it's not. I think it's really good. I rewatched it twice for fun, just to I didn't need to watch it a second time. I pretty much so knew where I was at after the first viewing. But I watched it again because of the fact that I just really enjoyed it. This had a comfort food access. I'm giving it low Jaws 1 because there's some, you know, faults of the time with kind of where the production's at. I struggle with it. I'm not disputing kind of where you landed, Paul. It was more on my end. I think this is something I could put in front of somebody and say, man, if you want to kind of get a flavor for Superman at the time or what superheroes were like at the time, this kicked it off. This is the first real superhero movie that was put into theaters. And I thought, as far as for a first step, it set a pretty cool bar as far as superhero stories being able to have unique storytelling.
I like the idea of low end Jaws 1. Because I don't think it trips into Jaws 2, which again isn't bad. I think it does everything it needs to do for being a movie of its time. I think it is very ambitious, both in terms of themes and in terms of trying to convey who this character is. I'm there too. I think this is a, for the first Superman theatrical film, because I don't count the serials, because serials were basically television on the movie screen. So that's a completely different thing. Those things were filmed as chapters, not as one long story. But as kind of a feature, this film does everything it needs. It just kind of ends. I mean, I remember watching Lois deliver her final lines, looking at the runtime. I'm like, we are literally 30 seconds from this being over. And then I remember they don't do long end credit sequences like they do today. I would give it low Jaws 1. I think it is a good Superman movie. I think it is a good introduction to the television series. And I think even though this was split up over two episodes, this was not a TV pilot. This was meant to be a feature on the screen. So that elevates it a little bit too.
All right. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's 58 minutes. It's not going to take that much time. I want to, just before we walk away, I want to thank you, Mike, for making the time to come on with me. I know we've been trying to do this forever, and I hope to not wait as long before the next time.
Yes, I'm so glad. No, once I get settled, I plan to kind of come out swinging with things. I've got something I'm planning for next year that I want to get a bunch of people roped into at some point. So, no, thank you very much. I appreciate you letting me come on and have fun with this. I love this movie. I don't know if anybody knows this. I kind of like Superman. I try to keep that really low key on the internet. I don't want really that to get out there.
Take a minute and tell everybody where they could find you, and to the extent that you want to tell us what your plans are for going forward.
FortressofAlietude.com is the easiest way to find me. I am in the process of moving things over from my old feeds to new Libsyn feeds because of various technical things that would bore everybody and no one's interested in. But all of that stuff is still out there. There is a main Fortress of Baileytooth feed that has all of my shows, Views from a Long Box, From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, It All Comes Back to Superman, Andy Leyland and I, which I do From Crisis to Crisis with Jeff Taylor. Andy Leyland and I do The Overlook to Dark Knight, where we talk about Batman stories. And if you have a spare 4.5 hours, as Paul mentioned, there was an episode of Back to the Bins where he, Andy, Bob Fisher, and I had about as much fun as four human beings could have talking about this show. I actually re-listened to it recently because I was mowing the lawn, and it was so much fun. And I would recommend, if you liked this, I would recommend
that. If you're interested in that, if you look back on the Is It Yours feed, I had republished that episode quite a while ago as a special, additional episode. So it is somewhere in the Is It Yours feed if you look for it. And I look back on that one as well, and I just remember how much I enjoyed doing it. And what we did was we each picked like 10 episodes of the series, and we went through them one by mm-hmm. one and talked about each one and how that series, what impact it had for us. So I'm kind of proud of what we did there, and I know I enjoyed the heck out of it. So I would definitely recommend it. In the meanwhile, we'll record again soon, but until then, Mike, you live your life and we'll live ours. And thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
I never thought I'd live to see anything like this.
Corrigan, before she gets hurt.
Mr. Corrigan doesn't have to get me out of the way. I can get out of the way by myself if I feel like it. But I just don't feel like it. Take your filthy hands.
Hold it!
Why, you dirty coward!
Get her out of the way!
Don't even try to get in there, Benson. Dr. Reed's in charge tonight. He's left orders that no one's to be admitted.
There's your answer, mister.
It may be an answer to you. It means nothing to me.
Yeah, well, we're running this town. We ought to string you up, too.
Yeah!
Are you all right, Miss Lane?
You're going to step aside or we have to make trouble.
Put some lead in him, Luke.
Mr. Benson tried that once already. It didn't work. Now I'm going to give you one last chance to stop acting like Nazi stormtroopers.
Who are you to tell us what to do?
All I'm telling you is that little creature in there has as much right to live as you do. Don't forget, you invaded his world. You sank a pipe 6 miles into the ground. And when he climbed up, you set dogs on him, shot him.
Get inside and stay away from the front of the building.
Whoever fired that shot came close to killing Miss Lane. Obviously, none of you can be trusted with guns. So I'm going to take them away from you.
Just left.